as of now, let's go on to our Sanchez versus State, case number 68492. To go. We have Mr. Qualls for the appellant and McCarthy for the state. And what I'd have you gentlemen do is introduce yourselves to the audience and tell a little bit about the case, and then that'll mean that you'll have more time for legal argument. Mr. Qualls?
Thank you, Aaron. Well, some of you stayed around. My name is Thomas Qualls. I am the appellate lawyer for Amadeo Sanchez, who was tried and convicted of first-degree murder. His defense was self-defense, and a big part of the issues on appeal are that his lifestyle and the lifestyle of most of the people in the case are not what we would consider sort of upstanding citizens or normal life. It involves kind of subculture world of drug dealers and drug addicts. And a lot of the issues revolve around whether Mr. Sanchez was given a fair trial, or perhaps whether he was convicted because too much evidence came in about the drug dealing and about his other bad acts, which we have to be careful at in trials. The jury doesn't convict him just because he has criminal propensities or lives a life that we don't really understand. Everyone is entitled to a fair trial. And even if we think someone's despicable, when we give up their rights, we give up our own. So that's a huge part of what the case is about. There are rules of evidence involved. There are prior decisions of this court that I will rely upon. But it's mostly about whether Mr. Sanchez received a fair trial.
Mr. Qualls, thank you. Thank you for not using the word deplorable.
Or basket choke.
Yes. Mr. McCarthy, what's the position of the state and Nevada in this matter?
The position will be that this was an eminently fair trial and the defendant was properly convicted. My name is Terry McCarthy. I work for the Washoe County District Attorney. I'm the chief of the appellate division, I think is what they call me. And since the entire division is three people, I'm the big chief. You'd be amazed at how much we agree upon. Mr. Qualls and I have known each other for quite a long time. We will agree on what the issues are, but for the most part, and how they ought to be resolved, and the process by which they should be resolved. And then we ask the court to go ahead and resolve it. And you'll see, my position will be this was a fine, fine trial.
Thank you, Mr. Kirby. Mr. Qualls, you ready?
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. For the record, I'm Thomas Qualls. I represent the appellant in this case, Amadeo Sanchez. At the risk of being redundant, I will just say again for the record, this is a murder case. It's an appeal in a murder case. Mr. Sanchez was convicted of first-degree murder, and it is not a case that involves upstanding citizens who are going to be nominated for sainthood anytime soon. These are people in general, including the deceased and my client, who lived their lives in a way most of us could not understand. And yet, as I mentioned, our laws protect them. And I would say, as a defense lawyer, it is eminently important, no matter how much we like them or don't like them or think their lifestyles and their behavior in general is despicable, that we go out of our way to make sure that the laws of this state and of the country are applied fairly to them, because those are the things that protect the integrity of this system. And I think that is when we are most challenged to maintain the integrity of the system. And it requires us to rise up a little bit and do the right thing, rely on precedent, and make sure that our laws are upheld. Specifically, this case involves a known drug dealer, Amadeo Sanchez, my client, who shot and killed one of his associates, also a known drug dealer, Danny Carter. The real question in this case is who was the initial aggressor and whether this was a self-defense case or not. There are no eyewitnesses to the shooting. The state's main witness, her name is Kristen Alarcon Hernandez. She was in the next room, and she heard some things, or testified as to hearing some things, but did not see what happened. She also happened to be a methamphetamine addict, someone who had, by her own admission, been using methamphetamine daily for 15 years, all the way through any of the relevant time frames in this case. In my appeal, I alleged four claims of error. Admittedly, the third one could have been more artfully crafted, which really leaves me three things to talk about here today. The repeated admission of uncharged other bad acts, the exclusion of relevant evidence of the character of the victim in a case in which the self-defense was the defense, and prosecutorial misconduct in violation of this court's order in Byford v. Stain. For each of these claims, a key consideration is whether these errors, alone or together, compromise the fundamental fairness of the trial. Key to making those decisions is deciding whether the state's burden was impermissibly reduced. And here's a quick assessment. The state's theory of the case was that Amadeo Sanchez came to the house where Mr. Carter was renting a room, specifically to collect a drug debt. They believe that Carter was unarmed and that Sanchez had shot and killed him while he was there. The state argued that the drug debt that Carter allegedly owed Sanchez was the reason that Sanchez killed him. Now, the problem with that theory, of course, is that if someone owes you money and you kill them, you're never, ever going to get that money back. So there's a flaw in the motive. On the other hand, if Carter tries to kill or kills Mr. Sanchez, if Carter kills Mr. Sanchez, the debt is forgiven and he gets a windfall. So Mr. Sanchez's theory that it was Carter who was the first aggressor makes some logical sense from that standpoint. And as it turns out, that story is supported by several witnesses. People like Mr. Carter's own roommate in that very house who said that Carter carried a gun with him everywhere and that she, someone who lived with him, had never seen him without a gun. Other witnesses testified that Carter was notoriously short-tempered, that he was a fighter, and that he would not stand for any kind of disrespect. The state's main witness, again, Ms. Alarcon Hernandez, said that just before she heard gunshots in the room next door, she heard Carter say something to the effect of, and I'll leave out the explicatives, but you can't talk to me like that, I'm not a bitch. Now, this is also consistent with Sanchez's theory and his story that Carter was the one that pulled the gun on him first. Additionally, two different witnesses testified that it was Carter who had planned to rob Sanchez and not the other way around. Even Ms. Alarcon Hernandez, state's witness, admitted that Carter and not Sanchez had threatened her in the past, threatened to punch her in the face, and threatened to take her dog from her due to the fact that she hadn't paid him for drugs that he planted her. Jared Calloway, who was certainly no friend of my client, Mr. Sanchez, because he and Carter had previously ripped off Sanchez in a drugs for guns deal. Again, these are not nice people doing nice things, but he testified that he saw Sanchez on the day in question and that Sanchez showed no evidence at all that he was mad at Carter or at Calloway anymore. And finally, supporting the Carter was the initial aggressor fact or theory is the venerable state's witness, Ellen Clark, M.D., who testified that there were 2,300 milligrams per milliliter of methamphetamine in Danny Carter's body when he died. She explained to the jury that that was almost five times the amount of meth that was regularly found in the blood of people who were arrested for other erratic and violent behavior.
With all those facts, how do you justify the fact that he was convicted of first-degree murder?
Pardon me?
How do you justify the fact he was convicted of first-degree murder? What happened?
Well, that's part of why we're here. I think he was convicted of first-degree murder because the jury thought he was a terrible guy who was a drug dealer, and so they didn't like him. Again, I will get into, I'll be directly into the other bad act errors.
Okay. Before you do that, Mr. Qualls, again, because we have students here who ask some questions normally wouldn't ask, or we'd be more specific, but just an education process here. Now, as you know, the Supreme Court's not a finder of facts, so we don't assess credibility of witnesses. Mr. McCarthy, I'm sure, is going to get up and argue that the jury heard all this evidence. He had the burden of proving the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury heard it. The jury concluded he was guilty of first-degree murder, and they're the fact finders, so why should we interfere with that verdict? You don't like that as a predicate. So I think you're getting into why now, into the specifics, but generally we agree that's the standard that we have to review it by.
Absolutely, and I'm not asking this court to refine any facts. I'm recounting all of this because it matters when we're weighing whether the evidence was close or not. What was actually presented at trial? If the evidence is just completely overwhelming that this is a first-degree murder case and I've got one or two evidentiary problems, you know, I know we've been around this block a few times. This court is just going to say, well, we find that that was error, but it's harmless because there's this huge weight of the evidence.
Well, I know you're going to get into the drug dealing evidence and all that, but anticipating that, isn't it necessary, and the court, district court concluded that the drug dealing was relevant, even though it's maybe considered a bad act, is it was part of the race, gesti, or Latin term, part of the complete story of the case where the jury understand what the relation was between Mr. Sanchez and Mr. Carter. So with that background, why don't you tell us why you think the judge committed error on that?
Sure, and certainly not everything can be justified as res gesti. And as you know, the test, and for the audience, the test for res gesti is whether can the story be told without talking about these facts, right? And so a huge portion of the I won't focus forever on that, but a huge portion of the trial was about he was a drug dealer. There's all these drug deals. Did he do this? Did he do this? Drugs. Dubious testimony about, yes, and he was associated with this Mexican drug cartel, apparently, and all of this stuff that I think is not necessary to tell the story of the case. If the theory is, which again doesn't really make sense to me, but if the theory is he owed him money. Okay, thank you. If the theory is that he owed him money and that's why he killed him, well, so we can talk about the debt. We can maybe even talk about the fact that he owed him money for drugs. Let's say that that is relevant to put it in the context. How much of that, though, is necessary, including this drug cartel stuff and all of that? But that's not all that there is. There's also Mrs. Sanchez, right, who gets to testify that when he was going into the house, he pulled a gun on her and told her to get in the driver's seat, which again makes no sense in the weighing sense. You know, she was also dating the cop who arrested Mr. Sanchez at the time when they found him in Mexico. So you can weigh that to her. You can throw that into the credibility and the overwhelming evidence or not thing. And then you've got random testimony that some other woman, he planted drugs to some other woman and she didn't pay him back and he was mad about it. How is that relevant to this? And I want to rely upon this court's decision in Walker. And the basic facts of that are, woman shoots husband, right? First degree murder case. Witness gets to get on the stand and say, well, years before, two different times, she had pointed a gun at him and threatened him. The Mexican court said, no. That doesn't have anything to do with intent to kill, and that she didn't fire the gun at him, and that's not close enough here. So if pointing a gun at someone that you later shoot and kill isn't enough, isn't close enough to be admissible as a prior bad act.
Did the defendant testify?
Yes, he did at the very end. Yes.
So credibility, as far as the jury, was allowed to decide credibility of all the witnesses, including the defendant.
Yes, in the end, yes. Let's see. Sorry, I lost my place just for a second there.
Well, can I ask you a question when you're looking on the bad acts? And I'll tell you an issue I have concern about that I'll bring up that this may be a mistake comment. There's the Mass Supreme Court case, which I think you referred to, Fields versus State, Linda Fields, that I know Justice Cherry and I were involved in that case and the argument that where the state in using bad acts, the bulk of the case against Linda Fields was other bad acts. It wasn't the particular murder which was the subject of it. And I think it was a huge percentage. And we reversed the conviction saying, look, the state relied too much on bad acts and not enough on the specific facts of the murder and all like that. Does that case take play in your mind to what happened in the trial and this case, knowing you were not the trial counsel, what's your thought about the proportion of time spent on these other bad acts versus the murder part of it?
I agree. That is my case. Fields is a little bit different in that they stood to gain some money through an insurance policy or something of that nature. The alleged murderers owed money, and so by sort of the case, the facts flipped around. So they killed the person that they owed money, so they didn't have to. So that's kind of Sanchez's theory. But I agree with you completely about the proportion of the case that spent kind of just smearing Mr. Sanchez, and then not allowing the reverse of that. And I'm relying upon this court's decision in Petty regarding the character of the victim. There was some impeachment that Mr. Olson was attempting to do as far as getting a prior violent act of the deceased through Miss Alarcon.
But he did get in that the fellow carried that Carter carried a gun all the time and had a violent temper. That did go before the jury.
That did come before. Yes. But there was another. there was another act in which he had actually shot at someone that he was involved with.
And as to that point, didn't we have a slight problem because he was asking a question that whatever information Alcorn Hernandez had was not firsthand, it was secondhand, it was hearsay.
Correct. And what is reputation evidence, right? In Petty and in other cases from this court involving the character of the victim, both reputation and opinion evidence, as well as specific facts, are admissible.
But that's the point. He wanted to ask her a specific fact opposed to the generalized style, if my understanding is correct.
I guess my response to be with that to be, it's either opinion or it's not. And in the Petty case, we're dealing with two probation officers who wanted to testify about information that was in a pre-sentencing investigation report, right? So that's hearsay too. But yet, we're talking about reputation that is something that she knew or heard about or whatever.
I'll give you 2 minutes to rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. McCarthy, I'll give you 17.
Good morning, Justices of the Supreme Court. I'm Terry McCarthy, WDA from Washoe County. On behalf of the state, and Justice Gibbons, you've anticipated my argument, so I'll just sit down now. That's right.
Experience. Mr. McCarthy appears in front of us a lot. So
McCarthy, thank you.
See you next time. Well, where to start here? There was pre-trial hearings on the subject of the habits, the customs of the actions of these players to establish the relationship between them. One guy is a dealer, and by the way, we didn't know that for sure until he testified and said, "Well, I'm a drug dealer." Yeah, and so that affected much of the trial. No one knows how a trial is going to proceed until you're done. As it turns out, this defendant stood up and testified, and he agreed with just about everything that was said up till that point. So if there was error, it has to be harmless. As he himself agreed, he said, I'm a drug dealer, and I went...
So the issue would have been a lot different if he chose not to testify on the bad act evidence and all.
It may have been. If it was error at all, it becomes harmless when he testified that this is all about drug deals and money.
He would have forfeited his right to self-defense, though, if he didn't testify. It would have been real hard to try to prove it, or to try to show a self-defense if you don't testify.
It is often a difficult decision for a defendant to decide whether to testify or not. In this case, he testified, and he agreed he is a drug dealer. But before the trial, there was a hearing, the state's motion in limine, to address these other things, the relationship between them. And there's Judge Freeman had a comment on that in the course of ruling. He said, this makes no sense. None of it makes any sense if we start at the moment he goes in the garage. If he's not there because of their history, if we can't explain, this isn't a random guy going into a random basement to shoot some other random fellow, it makes no sense. So the evidence is admitted to show the story.
It's not bad acts, it's res justi.
It is. Now, I also think, I'm not sure that the part about having the gun in your hand before you go in the house, I don't know if that's a bad act at all. We have the Petrocelli line of cases, and some things have to be resolved in pre-trial hearings outside the presence of the jury, but... Just having a gun, I don't know if that's among them. But procedurally, though, there was a hearing, and there was a discussion of the evidence supporting the fact that he had the gun, the fact that he's collecting the debt and all that. And Mr. Olson, who tried the case, and the prosecutor, they all agreed what the facts would show, and they only disagreed about how to analyze it.
And there was no doubt that the jury knew that Carter, the deceased, was a drug dealer also. In other words, that was plain. That was presented.
Yeah.
Wasn't hitting at all.
But that was over a drug deal, or multiple drug deals. As I understand it, he took drugs on consignment. Although I don't know if that's really the custom in the industry. But
what drug was it?
I couldn't say. Methamphetamine is very common.
Okay.
In these, as I recall, the defendant would acquire his drugs in Los Angeles and then bring them to Reno because the retail price was higher in Reno and the wholesale price was lower in Los Angeles. So it was
true economic story here.
It's a legitimate business decision, I suppose, if that was a legitimate business, but it is not. So on the day in question, he arrives at the home where the victim lives. And he pulls his pistol that he routinely carried. I don't know why I find it interesting that it was called a Mosquito, a small little semi-automatic compact gun. And he gestures to his wife to take the driver's seat. Then he goes into through the garage, goes into the house. There's an argument, and it was heard by the witness in the next room. And then, I think I can't emphasize this too much. It was five shots. There's an argument here that there's no evidence that this defendant intended to kill. You know, I think generally you shoot somebody five times. I think we can.
So the evidence was Mr. Sanchez fired all five shots. Then that
he's got the only gun. There is a gun.
There's no other gunplay. I mean, it wasn't shots. Mr. Carter didn't fire any shots.
There's no return fire. When the police show up shortly thereafter, there is another gun in the room. It is not accessible. And I don't think there's any evidence it was fired. It was atop of a piece of furniture.
It wasn't in Mr. Carter's hand or close to his hand.
No. It was unavailable to him. The witness had testified. They came in. And he routinely carried a gun, as so many in that business do. But when they came in the house, he retrieved his gun and put it up on top of the piece of furniture. I want to call it a chiffarelle, but that may be because I like the Atticus Finch story. Anyway, he put his gun up on top of the piece of furniture, and sometime later that the defendant shows up, there's an argument. He resents being talked to in a certain fashion, pulls his pistol, and fires five times. From that, plus the fact that he enters carrying the gun, I think the jury might infer that the crime was intentional and premeditated. So, and there was, I have to agree with Judge Freeman, is his comment before the trial at the motion in limine hearing. It makes no sense. You can't tell this story and have it make sense without explaining who these people are and what is their relationship to each other. And that's all it was. If we had had to go in and start at the garage, here's this fella who enters in someone else's garage for no reason, goes into the basement, pulls his pistol and puts a cap in. That doesn't make any sense, and the jury would be asking questions that then we wouldn't be allowed to answer.
What about the issue that Mr. Sanchez may not have testified if this race justice testimony had not come in, that because it all came in, he was kind of in a box and had to testify there? Does that play into this at all?
It may come into it eventually. Thus far, there's no record of it. He didn't claim that. He claimed he
that was never an argument made at the trial.
Mm-hmm. No, he claimed he wanted to clear his good name, that he's an honest drug dealer, that only kills people when it's absolutely necessary. So,
okay.
Was there an issue as to Byford and the issue of premeditation, deliberation, willfulness?
Yes, it's raised in the context of an objection, no actual objection, an argument concerning the closing argument of the prosecutor. Byford, as this court is aware, concerns instructions to the jury on how to distinguish between first and second degree murder, and it has nothing to do with the prosecutor's argument. The prosecutor merely argued that the evidence supported the inference the evidence should support the conclusion that, in fact, this murder was premeditated and intentional, and it was the process of calm reflection, or whatever the language was that the prosecutor used. So there's nothing in Byford that restricts a prosecutor from urging a jury to make inferences that are supported by the evidence. And, in fact, there was plenty of evidence supporting the inference of premeditation and intent, based specifically, to shot him five times, among other things. And there was also what was heard in the next room. And so there was no improper argument. Byford should be restricted to the jury instruction, not to the arguments of counsel. And by the way, on the subject of jury instructions, we probably shouldn't forget, juries are presumed to follow their instructions. And so if a court were to give a limiting instruction, for instance, we should presume that they followed them. And now, I expect the question, was there in fact a limiting instruction? And I really don't recall. Mr. Olson was offered the opportunity to have such a limiting instruction on the uncharged conduct, and I don't recall if he took advantage of that opportunity or not. If there was, that will certainly affect the case as well. Mm-hmm. Because we can't have this court substitute its mind for that of the jurors. We have to say, look, this is what they were told, and this is how they decided, and we can't speculate that they must have done something else. Mm-hmm. And of course they were told to decide based on the evidence. Here is what must be proved. There was no instruction that allows the jury to decide. If this fellow is a bad dude, then you may convict him of first-degree murder. There's no way a jury following their instructions could come to that conclusion. Instead, a jury following their instructions would take the evidence that he went in looking because he was angry and he wanted to collect a debt. And then it turned into an argument, he pulled his pistol and shot the guy five times, and that made it first degree murder. There is a suggestion that the evidence of the debt and the possession of the gun shouldn't have been admitted because there were multiple theories of the prosecution. That is, there's also a felony murder theory that allows a person to be convicted of first degree murder even without the intent to kill, if the crime is committed during the course of a burglary, for instance. But the argument that is presented would require the prosecutor to choose which theory to advance. And that is not the state of the law. The prosecutor may allege and prove both types of murder.
So the verdict form didn't differentiate between felony murder and first-degree murder with premeditation. Is that correct?
Yeah. No, it just says first-degree murder. Okay. That, by the way, is allowed by
Shad. I understand. I was just curious if any judges ever do the differentiation or if they all do just the one general verdict form for first-degree murder.
I saw a special verdict form last week. Yeah.
Did you? Okay. Interesting.
I think it had to do more with the weapons enhancement, but not the specific theory, but... Mm-hmm. And now, of course, someone says that was error to allow that.
But it's not error if the jury decides on different theories. In other words, some could decide on just premeditated murder, and the rest could decide on felony murder, and it's okay either way.
Yes, it is. So the U.S. Supreme Court in Shad has ruled that as long as they each agree it was first-degree murder, they don't have to agree between themselves which type of first-degree murder it was. I think Shad might have been arson and premeditated murder, and it could have gone either way or both ways, and the court said that's okay, we can live with that as long as everyone agrees it's first degree murder. Okay, so I wanted to respond to one more thing, and that is the suggestion that the murder, the decision to pull the trigger, was an effort to collect a debt. I don't think anyone suggested that. The defendant's presence in that daylight basement was an effort to collect a debt. You know, no one is suggesting that he thought he would get paid if he first killed the guy. Although, I imagine there are drug dealers that think that way and they want to send a message to the rest of the customers, but that wasn't an argument the prosecutor made in this case, and so responding to it doesn't seem to have any purpose here. Okay, so I think I have addressed each of the arguments, and it's my custom not to use all my time. So, and if the court has no questions, I'll sit down then.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Wells, you have two minutes in rebuttal.
I would say first regarding Mr. Sanchez's decision to testify, the record is certainly not clear as to why that happened, and it's certainly not clear as to what the content of his testimony might have been had all these bad acts not come in. But you're right, all of these bad acts coming in, some of them so far removed from the relevant elements of the case, sort of forces his hand is what he has to talk about when he's on the stand. Additionally, I think in that context, if this stuff was admissible, it should have been in rebuttal, not before the testimony. So if you're going to say, well, he needs to get on the stand to do self-defense, I mean, I suppose there are other ways to do that, but then that only becomes admissible once he testifies to them. So I still don't think you throw out the whole intent of Petruccelli, and I want to throw in the fact that there was no Petruccelli in this hearing. Judge Freeman elected not to have one. He specifically said he wasn't going to do it on the record.
Because it was raised just guy? Was that his reason?
I guess he had three reasons, which I addressed in the briefs. One of them was res justi, but none of them were the test under Petruccelli or under 48045.
So, didn't he consider the moving papers that were filed by the parties as to that issue? I know he didn't formally call witnesses, but did he consider the arguments that were made to the court by counsel in their pleadings on that issue?
Yeah, sure, yes. I mean, it was a pretrial hearing based upon the pleadings, yes.
More importantly, though, that question I need to ask you is that the record seems devoid of objections to the testimony of what you consider bad acts. Was that preserved by the motion or response to the motion in limine?
Yes, number one. And number two, a couple of times Mr. Olson did note a continuing objection to certain kinds of other bad act thing. I'd love to get into Byford for a second if I could.
I'll let you go ahead.
Okay, since we
have students here.
Your Honor. I realize that it's not improper or illegal or anything for the state, for the prosecutor to charge open murder, right? This is, but I feel like you start from a period of, or from an unlevel playing field then. The prosecutor gets to come in and say, we're not really sure how this happened, you guys pick. And then you follow that up with the prosecutor at the end, making up some facts and stating things that are directly contrary to the decision in Byford. I don't think the state gets to do that and then say, well, but the jury instruction was correct. Are we saying that nothing the prosecution says matters? The jury has been there for a week listening to this person who is obviously of some authority, and they're just supposed to discount what they tell them about the law. The jury are not trained in the law, so they're reading this jury instruction, from Byford, which is pretty long.
But would you like to point out to us what specific statements the prosecutor made?
Absolutely,
and were objected to.
Yes. Well, okay, they were not objected to. That's where you were going with that. They were not objected to. I think this rises to the level of plain error, though. When we have a Nevada Supreme Court opinion on point, and you have a prosecutor saying exactly the opposite of that. She essentially blurred premeditation, deliberation, and willfulness into just intent to kill. By the way, there is no issue about intent to kill her. That's the whole point of the Petty argument and that progeny, is that these other bad acts don't have anything to do with the intent to kill. I flipped that on its head. But the prosecutor is saying, and I cite this starting on 29 and ground 4 on the opening brief, the prosecutor is saying facts like, we pointed the gun at him while he's demanding money. Well, there's no eyewitnesses in the room, so nobody can say that that was ever a fact. There are other things like that, but she also says that in between shots, he made a, quote, cold and calculated judgment and decision to kill him. Well, that is the opposite of what deliberation is. And now we're back to pre-Byford, in which premeditation that can happen in a nanosecond and deliberation are the same thing. So she's telling the jury that whatever happened with the first shot, he can decide that, you know, from a premeditated and deliberate standpoint, to kill him right there in between those shots. That's called the heat of the moment, and that is contrary to the direct language of Byford, which says it's got to be made, the decision has to be made with the coolness of reflection. In the heat of the moment, right, like that, nobody would say there's any coolness of reflection. And I think the jury is listening to the prosecutor explaining the law more than they're understanding a point of word, and I think we can't discount that.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Thank you all very much.
Mr. McCarthy, Mr. Claus, thank you for your argument, your briefs in this matter. This matter will stay.